Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday. Lori Winters is with us this hour. We were terribly worried that Lori was about to go to Europe or some other city, and she is staying in Milwaukee. She is the marvelous former director of exhibitions for the Milwaukee Art Museum, and she brought us absolutely outstanding exhibitions we've enjoyed and we've talked about with Lori for quite a few years now. She conceived of an idea of the Art Consortium recently after she worked with museums in Central Europe, and she developed important relationships with museum directors and curators in Austria, Hungary, Germany, Poland, Switzerland, and the Czech Republic. And as a result, Leonardo da Vinci and the Splendor of Poland came to Milwaukee in 2002. Rembrandt and his time masterworks from the Albertina and Biedermeier, the invention of simplicity. And so Lori has set up this very interesting international consortium, which we'll be talking about, and it's partially a response to her interest in all this in European great museums and working with them, but it's also in response to museums perhaps putting together their exhibitions in different ways, in museum goers experiencing exhibitions in different ways. At any rate, she's still in Milwaukee. That's good. She has put her new organization in Milwaukee. So she is the president of the board and the executive director of the Art Consortium, and we'll hear all about it this hour and talk about museums and welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Lori.
Good morning.
I was so worried you were going to move away when I heard that news. I thought, no, Lori can't leave us because what you've done is so spectacular. What is it that made you decide to go on a real international scale now? What do you want to address that you haven't been able to address before?
Well, that's such a huge question. But
yeah,
let me say I'm my husband and I are both thrilled to stay here in Milwaukee.
Good.
And in Wisconsin, and we love the state. And honestly, I've had other opportunities and I've turned them down because I think this is a great city and state, and we do a lot of things and we think out of the box and we work above our potential, and that's all very exciting for me. So I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to bring the program here as well.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the nature of the program. Tell me about the experience that you had with the Albertina and with other museums that moved you into this, because it's a result of what you've done, what you're doing now.
Right. Some people think, well, this project just sort of emerged, you know, whole cloth out of the last couple of months. But actually, it's been something that I've been thinking about and talking about with colleagues in the field since 2008. Mm. And in 2008, I did a program called the Center for Curatorial Leadership. And I was thrilled to be part of that inaugural class, which prepares museum curators for leadership positions in museums. And at that point, I became very interested in what museums do, how they actually connect with their community, with their audiences, and what their potential is in terms of doing more. So that was sort of the initial thought. And the initial idea was really that I would put together with a great friend and colleague, Klaus Albrecht Schroeder, the director of the Albertina, a group of select museums in the U.S. and in Central Europe that would work on exhibitions together. And that was, I thought, a pretty good idea. We both liked it. We were both committed to doing it. And then in 2009, I did another leadership program for individuals in the museum field, and that was the Getty Leadership Program. And I had the opportunity during that summer to work on the project. And at that point, the project started to evolve to take on some of the more sort of controversial issues in the museum field. And immediately finishing that program, I was so inspired by thinking about sort of the administrative end of museums and the financial impact of museums that I worked on an MBA. And so the program has slowly evolved and I think has kind of transformed in the last 4 years. So it is now a group that focuses on topics like innovation in museums. I mean, how do you create it? How do you navigate the technology issue? we're taking on the topic of neuroscience and neuroaesthetics in the museum field. And that is, you know, how does the brain actually think about art? How does it take in information? What are things that museums can do to better help people, the visitor, understand art when they make that crucial visit? And specifically, how can you encourage the visitor to spend more time? I mean, lots of studies have shown that the average visitor in the museum may spend somewhere between 7 and 10 seconds looking at a work of art.
Ooh.
So as museum leader, of course, we want our visitors to spend more time thinking about the art and spend more time appreciating why it's so significant. And so, you know, there are ways that we can do that. We can help the visitor have a better experience in the museum. So those are some of the issues. Psychology and is another issue. For example, choice architecture. There's a wonderful book published recently by authors named Sonnenstein and Toller, Richard Toller from the University of Chicago. And Sonnenstein now works in the Obama administration. And what they've come up with is this theory of the psychology of human behavior, and they've labeled it choice architecture. And what that means is that there are certain things you can do to set up a framework for people to make better choices, better decisions, and to think in a better way. And so one of the things that we would like to do is to consider how that might be applied to the museum field. Hmm. You know, if our goal is really to help people look at works of art and appreciate it and understand why it's culturally significant, why it's significant for our communities, then we should be thinking about those kinds of things. So we're not a traditional sort of trade organization. There are plenty of those in the field, and they are focused on best standards and practices. And, you know, I'm on the board of directors for the Association of Art Museum Curators, for example. They do a fantastic job, but their focus is really best practices and standards. So we're interested in bringing in people from outside of the museum field to see what we might learn from other disciplines and how that could be applied to what we're doing. So we're hoping to open the box. We're hoping actually to get rid of the box and think about some of these questions. And I say at the very outset that I don't have answers. What I'm familiar with is the conversation. So we've brought into this group people who are interested in continuing the conversation and hopefully coming up with some recommendations.
Is this a field? Is what you're saying fairly radical for the museum, for the art community? Do people have a tendency to want to hold on to what they have, to hold on to the works that they have, to hold on to their reputation and not collaborate?
No, I think collaboration is something that most museums are interested in. But we've done that around exhibitions almost exclusively.
Mm.
And of course, that's something that's been very near and dear to my heart for the last 15 years as the director of exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum and as the curator of European art. So exhibitions are a crucial and really key form of participation. But what we want to talk about is the possibility that there might be other forms of collaboration that could take place between museums. So, for example, an obvious one might be shared curatorial staffs. You know, and I say sort of in jest, but, you know, why does every museum need to have its own expert or curator of Renaissance art? Why isn't that something that you can share among institutions and institutional thinking? So, you know, that, you know, I say that a little bit glibly, but that's one possibility. I think there are going to be a lot of possibilities that emerge, particularly when we can bring in people from the field of economics and social science and the business community who can help us think about these possibilities in new ways.
Mm-hmm. So you're having a major conference in Europe in, what, about a month and a half. Are you bringing together these people from all these different disciplines?
Yeah, absolutely.
Time? You are.
Right. Arho Klammer, who is we're bringing in Arho Klammer from the Erasmus University in Rotterdam, who is an expert on cultural economy and the economics for cultural institutions. And he's done a lot of work in this area and is very concerned about the financial situation that many museums, and especially American museums, find themselves in, which is that they have high annual budgets, small endowments. In terms of their annual operating budget, they tend to be fairly precariously positioned if they don't raise the money through gifts and sponsorships. I was talking recently to one of the museum directors, one of the two great museums in New York, and I won't mention his name, but his response was, you know, American museum directors in particular have a real problem because they are really only one financial downturn in the market away from a train wreck. And that's true. I mean, it's, we've grown and inflated our budgets to such a degree that there is a question of whether we can sustain that practice. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that I'm hoping this group will take on, as we have, you know, economists in the field who can help us think in different ways. And as I said, you know, I go into this completely saying that I don't have the answers. And there may be different answers for every institution. Certainly, a museum that's located in New York with its huge tourist population has a different market and different needs than what we would have in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or in Kansas City, or in Minneapolis. So those are the kinds of things that we want to open the conversation to. But we are going to at least have the conversation.
What are the big expenses for a museum, Laurie?
Well, the staffing is always a big expense. Exhibitions are a big expense. Maintenance, you know, mm-hmm. and things like insurance. Those are pretty big expenses for an institution.
Mm-hmm. When you have said that you want to, and I want you to talk more about this, encourage or enhance an aesthetic experience, a museum experience, when looking at it in a recent history perspective, when the way people are thinking is different than it was 20 years ago, what is that? Right. What does that entail?
Well, our attention spans, and all of the studies sort of support this, that our attention span is much less disciplined than it was 20 years ago. And that's due to the great technology that we have in TV and our computers. Mm-hmm. And so we're now kind of programmed mentally around 10-minute segments. And that's in line with television commercials. You know, we have a 10-minute we have a commercial every 10 minutes. So after 10 minutes, our attention begins to lag. So when the visitor does have a more rapidly decreasing attention span, the question is, you know, how can you work with that? And what are the expectations? I mean, it gets harder and harder for the visitor to spend a half hour or 50 minutes or even an hour and a half in an exhibition or in a gallery, because they're just no longer programmed to function in that way. Mm-hmm. So we wonder if there are things that can be done in installing an exhibition or installing a permanent collection that better helps the viewer. And I say that there is a kind of controversy now in the museum field, which is becoming more and more clear and more clearly defined, that there are sort of two camps. There is one camp that suggests that we need to follow the trend of including more technology into our galleries and exhibitions. Okay, great. And that's pretty self-explanatory. Another camp suggests that when we do that, we become more and more like all of the other fields which have introduced technology. And as a consequence, we lose what has made us unique. And as a consequence, we have this unique ability with the artwork to help people focus and to sort of gather their inner thoughts. And we lose that when we focus on the technology. And the Yale Center for British Art and Columbia Museums have, Columbia University, have created programs with their medical schools. So the museums are actually working with their medical schools to train interns, to train young doctors on how to focus and how to discipline the mind. And the young interns who come out of the program, and it's a required course for these young interns, they come out saying that they're better able to focus because they can better figure out sort of detail. They become better diagnosticians as a consequence of developing the discipline for focus. So that represents sort of the other camp. So there are these two very distinct groups within the museum field. And what we want to do through this organization, through the Art Consortium, is really to have a more focused conversation on that very topic.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about technology, you're talking about films about the artist, about all that extra that can be
an exhibition. It's the whole panoply, from films to smartphone technology to things that we haven't even imagined yet. And so it is an interesting question. You know, what should be the function of art in our age? And there was a recent article in The New Yorker. It's from, I think, July 2nd, where the director of the Tate Museum in London said museums are becoming something other than what we're used to, but we don't know what they're going to be in the future. Mm. And I thought that was a kind of perfect summary of our organization, sort of grappling with the direction of museums in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, you, I know, because I've been through many exhibitions with you, and you've taught me how to focus on certain mm-hmm. things. There is, it would seem to me that part of what you do is teach people how to focus, and you do it brilliantly. And I'm wondering if that's something that we all need to do. You sure want your intern and your doctor and your surgeon to be able to focus. And if you go to an art museum, you would also, and I know you've done this through bringing very few paintings or sometimes one painting, mm-hmm. so we have to focus on this, that it's perhaps the job of a museum to teach us how to focus because of all that we get from focusing?
I think there are real benefits from developing the discipline of focusing. And however you learn that, whether that's through art or through music or any other cultural, you know, artifact, then that's a great thing. And you referred to the one work exhibition. We did that with the Raphael, and that was a real experiment. And
It
was an experiment, and I think it worked very well.
Yes, it did.
We did have people who would spend, you know, up to an hour in the exhibition, sometimes even longer, and just sitting and enjoying the single work of art. This is, of course, all anecdotal, but I met on more than one occasion people in the gallery who said this was now their third or their fourth visit to see the single work. So that was great. That was a great experiment. And you know, there was, of course, some concern. Would a single work draw an audience? And if it doesn't, of course, that has a financial impact. So, you know, those are all things that you take into consideration. You know, I'm happy to say that it worked well. So maybe there are some lessons there for the future.
Yeah. We want to welcome phone calls. I don't even know what to tell you to focus on in our phones. You know Lori. Lori's been a wonderful friend of ours for many, many years now, and she is extraordinarily talented. I have been the recipient of her guided tours through many of the exhibitions that she has put together, and she's put together some marvelous exhibitions. She has changed her position now. She was the director of exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum until just last month, and she now has launched the Art Consortium, an international think tank that is going to start asking some of the questions that maybe they don't even know what the questions are going to be until they start gathering, but reshaping the future of museums, bringing together people from different disciplines to figure out how you can, as she says, encourage or enhance an aesthetic experience when the way people are thinking is quite different than it was 20 years ago. So maybe you have some ideas for her on how to do that. She has built, during the last 15 years, long-term relationships with museums all over the country, and particularly in Central Europe. And so this conference will, I'm sure, be very exciting. Special guests will be commentators who are critical of contemporary museum practices, economists, as she said, who study cultural institutions, neurophysiologists, I love this, who can talk about art and the brain and the issue of short attention spans, and technology people on digital, internet, mobile device revolution. When you go to museums, what kind of experience are you looking for? Do you like all the added technology? Do you think we have problems learning how to focus? feel free to give us a ring. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lori Winters is now president of the board and executive director of the Art Consortium. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lori Winters is our guest, and we'll welcome phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls, Lori, with Suzelle in Wauwatosa. Hi, Suzelle.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, I love art museums, and I love the Milwaukee Art Museum. And often when I'm in art museums, I have sort of a spiritual or ecstatic experience, which really it has to do with, you know, the visual nature of the art that I'm encountering, and of course my own background and my own love for art. And I'm curious, in terms of the new sort of new way of looking at what museums should be like, how do you factor in that kind of a thing?
Yeah, you bring up something that we talk about in the museum field, and that is the personal aesthetic experience, or the kind of, sometimes it's even called an escapist experience, so that people come to the museum to escape the frenzy of daily life and have a quiet moment, as almost as if you were going to a cathedral or temple. And that's something that we need to take into serious consideration. If you turn your institution into a kind of entertainment, you're certainly drawing an audience for that entertainment factor, but then you lose the, let's call it the escapist factor, that also draws a fair number of people. So it is really hard to find the balance between the two. And what is the obligation to the work of art, to the history of art, to presenting art in sort of an honest and truthful way? Basically it boils down to the question or the problem of, you know, what should museums be doing in the future? And it is I think a problem, because in either instance, you need to put money and resources behind the decisions that you make, and that is a financial commitment for the institution. It's also a commitment for your community.
She makes a good point. I didn't really think in those terms of the reasons why we go, but it is like going to church sometimes in the best possible way, and also it's enhanced sometimes by the building that you're in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I think we might learn from working with neuroscientists and those who study the aesthetic experience is how we can better display the work of art to deliver on that experience, whatever we want it to be. And there's more and more evidence to show that there are particular kinds of responses, whether you're aware of them or not, to different types of works of art. Some are very soothing, some cause great anxiety, some are difficult for people to look at. And so particularly for works that are, you know, we might describe as difficult to look at, you know, how can you put them into a setting which encourages a kind of thoughtful understanding of the work of art? And so those are some of the issues that we're hoping to take up. And so we'll see how it works.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Suzelle, for your call. Randy in Lavelle. Hi, Randy.
Hi. What's fascinating, if you travel into Russia, where they have the great impressionistic works, and they also have no money, both in St. Petersburg and in Moscow, the local art professors and so on at the universities have their little galleries around the great places there that display art, and you hire them to give you tours, and then you look at their galleries and you purchase art from them. They operate their museums on a shoestring, and they're pristine, they're fantastic. You want to go back for more and more. And so I've often thought, boy, is that a model? The knowledge you gain, you find out where the corresponding works that are displayed there are displayed in the United States. You find out more about our galleries by visiting theirs.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I'm glad you mentioned Russia, because one of the things that I've sort of consciously set out to do with this organization is to include museums in countries that haven't always been included on the international stage of conversation. So we've included works from or museums from Austria, from Germany, Switzerland, Hungary, Poland, and so forth. And I've spent a fair bit of time on different projects working in what I will call Central Europe or Middle Europe, and I'm just astounded by the quality of the collections, the eagerness and enthusiasm. And what I especially admire is the kind of unconventional, because they're working on a shoestring, the kind of unconventional thinking about the exhibitions they do, the way they display works of art. So I actually think there's a lot for us in the United States to learn from our colleagues in Central and Eastern Europe. That doesn't mean we haven't included museums from England and France and Spain. We have, because I want this group to be wholly international. And I, for the moment, we're talking just about museums in the U.S. and in Europe, and that's intentional. Our first 2 years, we're considering a pilot project as we begin to formulate the conversation. But in our third year, our plan is to expand into Asia, the Middle East, South America, and Africa. So the third year is our big year for expansion, and I think we have a lot to learn from our colleagues in those areas. And in fact, a conversation I recently had with my board of directors was focused on, well, do we really need to include museums, let's say, in Asia, because they think in such a different way? And I'm happy to say that we concluded, yeah, we absolutely had to, because it was that new thinking that really drives our organization. I think there's a lot to learn from museums around the world.
Mm. Thank you so much, Randy, for the call. I was thinking about museums and history. I've spent time recently in Washington, D.C., as have members of my family, and I'm always think about, you go see things and then you realize, I got to go learn more about this because I should have known this when I came and I didn't. And what is the background, the historical background? I want to learn about these people's lives. How do museums take in that factor of how much you should know and whether or not you should know some body of knowledge before you have that experience with a painting, with a work of art?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that we really don't have a lot of answers to. It's all anecdotal in some ways. Most museums do surveys, and interestingly, some surveys have shown that you can provide too much information.
Really?
That it becomes overwhelming. Mm. So finding that sort of perfect balance of providing enough information for someone who's maybe making a visit to a museum for the first time and really doesn't have a background, that's fine. You want to give them enough information that they walk away feeling that they have some understanding of what they've just seen, not that it was just pretty and it looked good on the wall. But you can also overwhelm the visitor. And so it is something that we struggle with all the time in terms of trying to find the correct balance.
Let's go to Raj in Madison. Hi, Raj.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was calling because of my thought about the fact that the American public or American media, one very often sees manifestations of art from the Far East, not as much from India, but very little from the Middle East or the area of the Fertile Crescent. There's the period that was dominated by Islamic art, but before that there was also the Byzantine art and the art of the Semitic tribes that predate all of these, I've seen manifestations of it when I've visited in the Middle East and seen people trying to recreate modern art items that replicate these ancient arts, And I was wondering whether that's one of the things that you give consideration to. For example, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is the art involved in the icons of the Eastern Church that predates the development of iconography in Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. You probably know from my work at the Milwaukee Art Museum that I was, you know, absolutely committed to bringing great work from Europe to Milwaukee and to the United States. I mean, I felt that it was, you know, an obligation and a mission to do so. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue to do that now as an organization. And, as I said, we've moved intentionally kind of slowly on that factor because, my area of expertise is European. The chair of my board, who I've worked with now on three exhibitions, Klaus Schroeder from the Albertina, also has an expertise in European and somewhat in American. So we're building a cohort of people beyond the sort of immediate circle who have expertise in the Middle East and in Asia who can help us make the right decisions about participating museums and institutions. And we hope to be ready to launch that part. Maybe I'll come back then and talk about, you know, so the global consortium in 2 years.
But, Lori, this is such a huge project, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I have to say, it's an organization whose membership is by invitation of the board of directors. And we've been very focused on that because we feel that the organization can't be too big. If it is going to function as a think tank, if it is going to have real and intense and ongoing conversations, then it can't be too big. It can't be an organization with 2,000 members. So we're thinking at this point that the ideal size is roughly between 60 and 80 participants total. And the people who are coming into the organization, are from fantastic museums like the Nelson Atkins and the Minneapolis Institute of Art, the Victoria and Albert, the Royal Academy, the Albertina, of course, and just so many wonderful institutions. But they come into it with a seriousness and a commitment that has even kind of surprised me. There is just a great enthusiasm to have this conversation. And it's interesting, the director of the Minneapolis Institute of Art has just, when I spoke with her in actually great detail about the organization, she just kept saying, this is, you know, it's fantastic because, you know, my board and I have just revised our strategic plan to make a commitment to the global arts. So she sees this organization as part of a fulfillment of that strategic plan that she's created with her board for her institution. So, we have a lot to deliver on, actually. Yeah. I'm confident that we can do that.
And how will you go about taking on these issues? Is it face-to-face that will make all of you focus better? Can you use technology to move along these big ideas?
You know, there is a benefit to the spontaneousness of a face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. So we are committed to regular meetings as a group. And members have been invited not on the size of the institution or on the quality of the collections, but rather on the innovative character of the leadership. Are there people who have tried different things, who are best described as risk takers, mm-hmm. who are interested in first of all in having the conversation? So that's a fairly select group of people, and getting those people, and I have to say they come with very different opinions on the two camps in the museum field. And so getting those people together and letting the conversation go where it will, I think, is going to be important.
Mm-hmm. Just have a lot of good food and coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
Always important. Thea in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Thea.
I have a question about whether you plan any discussions about cultivating ties to local artists and local art organizations wherever these museums are located?
Well, yes, of course. I think that's part of any conversation is what are the best ways in which a museum can connect with its community? And that community is different for every museum. It's certainly, you know, different for a museum like the Minneapolis Institute of Art than it is for the Metropolitan or the MoMA in New York. Those are completely different audiences, and so the conversation would be quite different. But yes, it is a conversation that we want to have, and it'll be part and parcel of what we focus on.
Thank you for the call, Thea. Debbie in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, I wanted to say that I had gone to the Art Museum in Chicago, Illinois, recently. My mother had come up from Florida. She's in her 80s and has a little bit of difficulty walking, but she really, really wanted to go, as we'd gone in the past. So we went, and it was a NATO week, so there was a lot of security. Mm-hmm. And everybody, all those workers at the museum, the people that checked us in, everybody was so kind and so helpful. It was an experience, you know, it was maybe the last time I'm taking her to that museum. And it was absolutely wonderful that everybody was so kind and helpful and answered any question. It was absolutely amazing. So it made our trip to the museum much more enjoyable than if they hadn't been that kind to us.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, it is part of the whole experience. It's not just the artwork that you see on the wall or in the gallery, but it is, you know, from the time you enter the front door, even from the time you park your car, it is part of the whole experience of visiting a museum. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you so much, Debbie, for the call. We have lines open now. Lori Winters is our guest this hour. Lori has started a new international think tank which is dedicated to shaping the future of art museums. She has launched it. She was, as you well know, she's very well known in this area because she was the director of exhibitions for the Milwaukee Art Museum and put together some absolutely wonderful and very, very successful, we might add, exhibitions at our beautiful museum. So she is with us to talk about the purpose of the consortium, and what they're going to be doing and the risks they're going to be taking and how they're bringing people in from many different disciplines to look at the future of art in museums, first in this country and in Europe, but eventually in the whole world. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Claire in Whitefish Bay is our next caller. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I must commend Lori for all her work. It's been wonderful. And I enjoy coming to the museum, but I'm older. It's hard for me to walk. It's hard for me to stand. I get very tired. And so I think another way that museums can be very user-friendly and get more people to come is to provide a seating area, benches, in each gallery so that people can sit down and look at the art or rest. And I find that that's missing at the Milwaukee Public Museum. There should be more benches to sit on. And also in the galleries. And then in Denver, they have a neat thing. In one of the galleries, they have chairs to sit on, and it's in the European section, and they have books there that you can sit and read about the art, and if you want to explore more. And I think that's a nice thing, you know, a nice feature. So, okay, that's my comments.
Thank you, Claire.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It's interesting that you mentioned Denver, because the Denver Museum of Art is actually one of the participating museums in the consortium.
Really?
Yes. And I know the director there, Christoph Heinrich. We are actually colleagues. We go back to the Getty Leadership Program. We both did the Getty Leadership Program together, and Christoph was someone who heard about this organization when it was still in an embryonic stage. So I'm happy to be able to include him in this organization, and happy that you have such nice things to say about that museum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's go back to being a risk taker, because I find this interesting. You don't often hear that term, I think, associated with major museum directors in the world. It's not something you think of when you think of tradition, you think of exhibitions that have been there for a long period of time. At least I do. Maybe other people do think differently. And I'm wondering about the role of risk-taking in the consortium that you're leading and in your life as director of exhibitions as well. I think you probably do consider yourself a risk-taker in many areas, and I'm wondering if that is problematic in your field, if we need more of it in the field?
Well, it's an interesting question, because you're right. We do tend to think of museums and the people who lead them as being kind of tradition-bound. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It is a tough question. I guess I do consider myself somewhat of a risk-taker. And I'll just go back to the example of the single exhibition, a single work exhibition that we did, the great Raphael portrait, La Donna Volata. And that was certainly a risk. At the time, we didn't know whether that would attract an audience at the Moleky Art Museum, whether a single work could hold people's attention. And I'm happy to say that it did, and we programmed it in very unconventional ways in terms of the kinds of events and lectures that we built around that single work. Also, our big Summer of China extravaganza was also somewhat unconventional. It was the first time we had ever done an exhibition of Chinese art. And not only did we do one exhibition, but we did five concurrent exhibitions.
I remember.
So that was a big financial risk and a commitment. And, it just goes back to how I sort of think about the world and the obligation that we have in the museum field to provide a more global perspective. Mm. So it was very important for me to do that exhibition, the whole Summer of China, because I felt that it was, it was bringing a new culture and a new way of thinking into the Milwaukee Art Museum. And actually, that's one of my sort of proudest moments at the museum, was to be able to offer that to the community.
Mm. Well, it was spectacular. The other thing that this museum does, and I'm wondering if other museums need to follow this as a model, or if it's happening in museums all over. I am just astounded by the number of lectures that take place, the children's activities, the people who may have some historic connection to a painting, family members, etc., who are found in various parts of the world, who come in to talk. It's become this huge experience now when exhibitions are on display. Is that what museums need to do? Is it good to have that? Do you need it for financial reasons?
Well, I have personally always thought that those are ways. There are avenues for us to anticipate the experience of the exhibition or the work of art. The more that we can help the visitor on a variety of levels, whether that's through a family experience or whether it's through what I would call a more expert's experience, like an expert lecture or something of that nature, those are avenues for us to help make a connection and bring the artwork alive. And to continue the significance of the artwork, perhaps in a different way from the day in which it was made.
Let's go to Jan in Appleton. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I believe that more is more. Thank you, by the way, for last summer and the wonderful thing that you did with the Chinese. I love that old salon style when if a museum had just great stuff, and there was a lot of it on the wall to see. And then there was a change where people were taking a lot of it away and just showcasing a few things like beautiful gems. And I think when you take away a lot of the choices, that's assuming that you have the time to spend with all this. I think more is more, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and that's part of the question that we'll be addressing. Is it better to offer more, or is it better to focus on a few key works that the experts in the field regard as significant? Mm-hmm. There are people on both sides.
Thank you very much for the call. Here's an Facebook email or something from Christina in Mount Horeb. My favorite way to see a museum is the London model. You simply walk in for free with no lines to stand in and see what you have time and energy for. If I happen to be in the neighborhood of the National Gallery only an hour before closing, I can still go see a favorite section. Likewise, if I have any children with me, I don't feel pressured to keep them there long enough to get my money's worth. I understand museums need money to operate. I'm more than willing to pay the cost most of the time, but costs and lines deter the casual repeat visitor.
Yeah, more museums in Europe, more often than not, are free. And, you know, London and the National Gallery is a great example of that. So I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a fantastic museum, and it is one of the benefits. There are some museums that have made a concerted effort to eliminate an entrance fee. And the Detroit Institute of Art is a good example of that. They have just levied a tax, which will enable them to. Yeah, and this has all just happened within the last month. So they found it very difficult to maintain their annual budget. It was, in fact, they described it as being unsustainable. And they did go to their community and ask for a tax, and it was approved. So they are going to be able to offer free entrance into the Detroit Institute of Art. So more and more museums are considering that as an option. Now, I'm just going to, because I always like to take a look at the other side, there are museums in the U.S. that have, within the last 10 years, that have gone from a fee structure for entrance to a free entrance. And interestingly, they have found that their attendance did not increase, and that as a consequence, they also lost an important revenue stream. So those are things that you need to take into consideration. It's nice to say, gee, let's have a free entrance. And one hopes and believes that that will garner a larger attendance. But actually, the financial models at this point don't bear that out. So, you know, it seems as if the experience is valuable for people, then they're also willing to pay for it. But I do understand your comment about the National Gallery in London. I think it's one of the great museums in the world.
Hmm. What are the great museums in the world, Laurie?
Well, certainly the National Gallery in London, the Tate, the National Gallery in Washington, you know, the Met, MoMA. I think there are also a lot of smaller museums that I would qualify as great just because of what they're doing. And the Beiler Foundation in Switzerland is certainly one of the great museums, and just not only in terms of the collection, but the way that it's installed, the way that the museum is sort of situated into the countryside, and it's in Switzerland, if you're not familiar with it. So you can look out these wonderful expansive windows and see, you know, cows with bells around their neck.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that too, actually. It's very sweet. So it is, I think, one of the great museums in the world. You know, the Kansas City Museum, the Nelson Atkins, is doing really interesting things. And I have to say that in terms of the collection, not only is it great, but just in terms of what their program, and it's sort of as soon as you walk in the door, you have that immediate experience of being someplace special, and the people there are who work there are special and helpful, and you know, and I'd also say that, you know, LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, is really doing some interesting things, particularly in the area of contemporary art these days. So if you're ever in California, I strongly recommend going to LACMA.
So you're gathering when? This first meeting? First meeting's coming up, right?
Right. Our first meeting is in Vienna, Austria, and the chair of our board of directors is hosting the first meeting. And that's Klaus Albrecht Schroeder, and that's October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. So two and a half days, full days of conversation about some of these topics. And you know, people always ask me, well, you know, are you going to come away with answers? I think it's likely that we won't. I think what we'll probably do at our first meeting is set the framework for the conversation, which will be ongoing. And I think the answers, quote, you know, in quotation marks, might be different for different institutions. But I think what this group will offer us is the opportunity to have an informed conversation so that we have confidence in the decisions that we're making.
Yeah. And who knows where you will go? Who knows what new ideas there will be?
I think that's exactly right. I think we've set this up as a framework that will foster innovation. At least that's my hope, and innovative thinking. And so, I don't want to provide too rigid of a framework, because then you will limit that creativity. And I think we may move in directions that I never even anticipated, and that would be great.
Mm. Thank you, Lori. Thank you so much. Thanks. Lori Winters, now president of the board and executive director of the newly formed Art Consortium. And we thank her so much for being with us. She, of course, was director of exhibitions for the Milwaukee Art Museum for a number of years and did a terrific job. Terrific, terrific. Well, that's it for today. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program. And thank you, everybody, for listening and calling. We'll be with you again tomorrow. And I hope you'll listen to many great hours ahead.